His charm is so contagious, vaccines have been created for it. Years ago, he built a city out of blocks. Today, over 600,000 people live and work there. He is the only man to ever ace a Rorschach test. Every time he goes for a swim, dolphins appear. Alien abductors have asked him to probe them. If he were to give you directions, you'd never get lost, and you'd arrive at least 5 minutes early. His legend precedes him, the way lightning precedes thunder. He is the most interesting man in the world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live on the Alternate Current Radio Network and also at 21stCenturyWire.com. Thank you so much for rejoining us. And we've got our next guest just waiting in the wings. He's in the green room right now having a cup of tea. But before we connect with Adam Gary, I just want to give a big shout out to our friends at New Dawn Magazine. And the New Year's edition is set to hit it's coming off the press, I think, in about 10 days. And it will be ready before New Year's or right around New Year's. And I think I've done a feature for that. It might be the cover story. I'm not sure. We'll find out when it arrives in my hand. But I've basically have written a scathing indictment against Google. And their sort of use of artificial intelligence and algorithms to censor and to de-rank and to sort of decide for you what you should be able to see when you put search terms in the internet. They want to sort of segregate content so as to what's trusted and what they call fake news or politically inconvenient or dissident language that they're trying to sort of marginalize. And they're making those decisions for us, and that's in this edition, and you'll only be able to get that there. And I really appreciate the job that they do at New Dawn Magazine and curating pretty much one of the most interesting magazines, no pun intended to the title of this show, but it is one of the most interesting magazines in the world. And as Alexander Dugin said, this is the magazine that can help you make sense of what is basically a weird, weird world that we live in. It certainly is a weird world, and thank you, Dugin, for that great quote about New Dawn Magazine. So check out, there's ads and links. You can pick up a single issue. If you want to subscribe, you know, go ahead. It's a good subscription to have. I think it's bi-monthly or quarterly, I'm not sure. But certainly it's good to have a physical copy in your hand as well that you can show people, lend to people, have it at home, give someone as a gift. It's always interesting. And I'm happy to be writing in the political, the geopolitics section for them for a while. And there's other stuff in there, other content. They've got health and all sorts of other things and some, you know, ancient history and all sorts of stuff. So great job at New Dawn Magazine by the team there. And you can pick up a copy there. Just go to the show page or in the margins and hit that and see if there's any deals going maybe for New Year's. Possibly, we'll see. Now, our next guest is also many things, but is currently the editor-at-large of the Duran.com. And he's also a regular on Crosstalk on RT. And his name is Adam Gary. He's been on the show before, and he's joining us on the live link from London. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Patrick. How's everyone doing?
That's pretty good. How's the Christmas spirit in London? London's always a great place to be for Christmas.
Oh, humbug. Did I say that? No. there are Christmas lights and even more brake lights in the heavy, heavy traffic. So there's my attempt to put everyone in a jolly mood.
Brake lights. I like that. So Christmas lights and brake lights. So that's good. That's good. So Oxford Circus, Regent Street, that's usually like the best place to go if you want to see the lights and stuff like that. It's always nice. Although it's gotten a bit weird, Adam. They've got like video, a lot of video walls and all sorts of other sort of high tech decorations. I just like the old holly and the, you know, and the wreaths. That's good enough for me. And the fairy lights, that's enough.
I know, it's better than, you know, the two-way mirrors, the CCTV cameras everywhere, you know, false flags blowing in the winter snow. I prefer the old-fashioned ways, absolutely.
Yeah, false flags blowing. Let's hope there's none of those. They had that.
There's been some weird stuff going on, but luckily not weird enough for anyone to get hurt. So let's just hope it stays that way.
Did you see that sort of false alarm they had a couple weeks ago on Oxford Circus?
I saw that. It was really weird because when they started reporting it, they were reporting terrorist police are on the scene. They sent out mixed signals about whether or not police were confirming it was a terrorist incident. And it turns out that it was just a stampede caused by, I still don't know what, but I assume there were early reports of smoke, still unverified, but it could have just been some little mechanical fire in the very old electrical boxes and the fuses. And someone shouted something, caused a stampede. And it doesn't bode well if it were the real thing. But what gets me a bit worried is that it seems that there have been a lot of tests going on both sides of the Atlantic, which are trying to sort of test people's reaction to various things. And I think that's a real, you don't want to play with the lives of citizens. You don't want to toy with people's minds using what's essentially psychological warfare. So people have got to be vigilant against the real thing, but they've also got to be vigilant against the psychological warfare techniques that people use against regular people just, you know, going to see the lights we were talking about.
Yeah, I think if you work in the upper echelons of law enforcement, that's called resilience that they're testing. So public stress test to see the resilience of the British public, that Theresa May seems to be reminding us of how much resilience that we need to have deal with the terrorist threat, because the state might not be there to protect us. So we just have to have that resilience in our pocket just in case. So I hear this more and more. But those shots fired were the original reports of that, Adam. And what I read out of that story was the stampede was caused by the police running around shouting at people to go shelter in place and to sort of, you know, whatever, move off the street or off the sidewalk and get into that shop. They're literally screaming at people. That's what caused the stampede. That's what I read from that
story. That makes total sense.
Yeah. So anyway, that's not what you want to see if you're out Christmas shopping, and hopefully you don't. So bizarre. Now, let's get into some news. And, you know, one of the reasons we got Adam on the story this week is I just saw this Newsweek cover, Adam, and I thought this was a spoof, but no, it's real. It's got a picture of Vladimir Putin, and it says, Putin is preparing for World War III. Yeah, that's bad news, it says. Yeah, that's bad news, says Newsweek. Now, I don't have a lot of general respect for Newsweek as a publication. I mean, anyone that would put Kurt Eichenwald on salary for that long is not really a proper news organization. But anyway, they're a shadow of their former self, and they were in the sort of, I don't know if they still are, they're under the sort of the Barry Diller empire there with the Daily Beast, Newsweek there, and the sort of that sort of end of the fake news mainstream industry. But this is just blatant. This is psychological warfare, but it's not pointed at Russia. This is pointed at the American people, Adam, this publication. I was just, I'm looking at this as a cover story at Christmas. I'm thinking, what is war? You know, are they trying to prepare the public for the possibility of war? Or is this just the last ditch sort of desperate move to try to, I mean, there's not many cards you can pull, Adam, after you sort of pull the World War III card. There's not much left in the deck after that.
No, what they're doing, as you say, it's entirely directed towards the Western public, mainly the US, but also in Europe. It's not directed to Russia at all. Russia at first thought that the whole thing was strange. Then they thought it was mildly amusing, then mildly annoying. And now they just realize that it's par for the course. Just as if you're a Middle Eastern country that happens to have an Islamic majority and happens to have gas or oil, you should be prepared for lies about weapons, the lies about where the weapons are transported, lies about how big the weapons are. And we all saw Nikki Haley talk about Iran the other day. We've of course got James Mad Dog Mattis. Think of what a female dog is, and then you can hear the non-family friendly version of what I call Nikki Haley. The Russiagate story and the whole Russia demonization that is implicit in it and beyond it is all an attempt to stifle, confuse, and frankly bewitch the American public into thinking that somehow all of the money spent by the federal government in the U.S. on the deep state is somehow doing something more important than if it went into things like streets, bridges, airports, the kinds of things that Trump, before he became Mr. President, like Obama and Bush before him, was saying that was necessary. And there really is a trend here. At this time last year, Trump had won. He hadn't entered into the White House. I had some cautious, very high hopes. But when you think about what Bush and Obama said, it puts things rather in context. In 1999 and 2000, when W. Bush was running against Gore, he said, no nation building. The U.S. will no longer be in the business of nation building. Now, this was the term that was used at the time to imply no foreign interventions. And he was being mildly critical of the illegal and devastating and counterproductive and immoral war that Bill Clinton launched on Yugoslavia to get Monica Lewinsky out of the headlines. Then when Bush came to power, we all know what happened. Then we had Obama. He was hope. He was change. He was the young star of the Democratic Party who would close Guantanamo and stop the wars. Then four more wars and one big bloated Guantanamo later, plus really deteriorating relations, even by Bush's standards, with both Russia and China, and we all know what Obama represented. We're in the same boat now with Trump. The only difference is on the domestic front, Trump isn't playing ball with the establishment, whereas Bush and Obama became the middle management of the deep state and did so, certainly in Obama's case, exceptionally well. He was the most eloquent spokesman for the HR department, if we can put it that way, for the deep state that one could imagine, where Trump is sort of a disgruntled employee, very disgruntled indeed. What we've got right now is we as people who are media consumers, and I don't consume mainstream media, but I do occasionally look at it to see just what they're inflicting on those who aren't yet aware of the fact that you can get news from real radio stations like this, real television outlets like RT, real websites, the dozens of them that you ran, simply one of many good websites. And so if you were to put yourself in the shoes of someone who didn't know that truth is actually possible in this digital age and who was stuck in this past mentality, this is how he would wake up on Monday. Russia is going to invade Europe. They've got submarines that are ready to target Washington, D.C. It's sort of the Cuban Missile Crisis, U2 crisis on steroids, all combined with a sort of apocalyptic vision of Stalinism meets Tsarism and this weird thing called Putinism, which is not anything you'll hear in Russia. There's no such thing as Putinism. There's such a thing as Russian policy that isn't particularly ideological. And that's what Putin and those around him have pursued for some time now. Waking up on Tuesday, it's Kim Jong-un, that man who on Monday was a wee cartoonish character from a South Park cartoon whose missiles don't go anywhere and who's sitting at the piano like his father singing I'm So Lonely. Now he's a man whose missiles can kill everyone in the world and you've got to be afraid of him, even though North Korea has invaded no one since 1953 and the United States have invaded almost everyone. to put it a bit hyperbolically, but not much. Then on Wednesday, you wake up in the morning, and who are you supposed to fear? It's a close one, but this time it's Bashar al-Assad. Even though he's fighting al-Qaeda, the group accused of doing 9/11, and fighting ISIS, a group that beheads people left and right for the crime of being born into the wrong faith, the crime of not obeying the insane throwback rules, or the crime of being the wrong ethnicity. He's fighting them, but somehow you're supposed to be afraid of him, and Bibi Netanyahu is all too happy about that. It's Thursday morning, and who are you supposed to wake up fearing? This time it's Iran, another country that has invaded no one in modern history, a country that is actually working with the legitimate governments of Iraq and Syria, fighting al-Qaeda, fighting ISIS, and somehow they're the bad guys, even though everyone, including America's European allies, are saying that they're in full compliance with this Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, and aren't doing anything wrong. If even the French and the Germans are saying this. It's what day are we on? I think we're on Friday now, and we've run out of ideas, so Putin is going to steal your internet. Never mind that the US Congress just destroyed so-called net neutrality, which essentially brings further corporatization to the internet world. But no, it's Putin who's going to steal your internet. Tune in to Saturday's show to find out what he'll steal next. And that is my sort of week minus a day summary of the cycle of mainstream media. North Korea, Russia, Iran, Bashar al-Assad, Russia again, back to the beginning, and there you go.
And don't you think it's more than just a coincidence that you do get this Russia? Okay, gosh, I want to get to Nikki Haley, but then, okay, let's get to Nikki Haley first. I want to talk about the Russia undersea cable Hunt for Red October story, because that thing has been recycled twice since 2015, and I'll show that in a minute. But so you brought up Nikki Haley. I didn't bring it up. I sort of did bring it up, but you sort of went for. So Nikki Haley is on the warpath again. Okay, so my personal feeling is with this person, I honestly think that this person has no conscience. I look into her eyes. Who said this? I looked into, I think Obama said it when he met Putin. No, who said that?
That was Bush when he met Putin. The great uncommunicator himself.
Did he say he looked in Putin's eyes and he saw the soul of the man? No,
he looked into Putin's eyes and he said, I saw the man's soul. And that was it.
I bet it was a good influence on him too, because he became more sort of, this is the thing with presidents, Adam, that they're like, it's like NFL football players who supposedly graduated from universities. They, after sort of 10 years in the league, they become quite articulate. They can give interviews. They're pretty much on their game. It does take a while though. With Bush, it took him like 4 or 5 years to sort of appear like he was literate, and that there was that scene in after 9/11 where he's reading to these kids in a school in Florida, and the book was called My Pet Goat, but he was holding it upside down while he's reading. Anyway, he did figure out all of these skills, how to be a president, how to read, how to give interviews after 8 years, and Trump will do the same. I wouldn't be surprised if Trump wins a second term. But anyway, Nikki Haley, I don't think she's got a soul, or if she does, it's just so far in the rearview mirror that I listen to this woman and I look at the robotic delivery, and I'd be willing to bet, and I know this is going to be really controversial, but she would be clinically diagnosed as a psychopath. And so who would give up a cushy job as governor of South Carolina, a totally cushy job in a nice, fairly safe seat there, probably move on to be senator, another cushy job where you don't have to do a whole lot. I mean, it's a charm life. She could even play her cards right. She'd be the female vice president on some ticket, maybe the next ticket. Who knows? She took a job that is the most corrupted, worst job you can take in the U.S. administrative setup, which is U.S. ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton, Samantha Power, now Nikki Haley. Which of those three have come out looking better after their term as U.N. ambassador than when they entered? I mean, it's a cursed job. So here she is throwing out this evidence here, and it's amazing. She's standing behind a big graphic, and she's presenting the evidence, and we'll go ahead and play this so you can hear it. And listen to this, listen to her.
As President Trump announced on October 13th, the United States is taking a new approach to Iran by focusing on all of the regime's destabilizing behavior. That means we are not just focused on the nuclear program. We're also taking a hard look at Iran's ballistic missile program, its arms exports, and its support for terrorists, proxy fighters, and dictators. Our new strategy was prompted by the undeniable fact that the Iranian regime's behavior is growing worse. The nuclear deal has done nothing to moderate the regime's conduct in other areas. Aid from Iran's Revolutionary Guard to dangerous militias and terror groups is increasing. Its ballistic missiles and advanced weapons are turning up in war zones across the region. It's hard to find a conflict or a terrorist group in the Middle East that does not have Iran's fingerprints all over it. In this warehouse is concrete evidence of illegal Iranian weapons proliferation gathered from direct military attacks on our partners in the region. Behind me is an example of one of these attacks. These are the recovered pieces of a missile fired by Houthi militants from Yemen into Saudi Arabia. The missile's intended target was the civilian airport in Riyadh, through which tens of thousands of passengers travel each day. I repeat, the missile was used to attack an international civilian airport in a G20 country.
Ooh, in a G20 country.
Just imagine if this missile had been launched at Dulles Airport or JFK, or the airports in Paris, London, or Berlin.
And I suppose they could let that one off in 45 minutes or less, right?
The famous, if Sadomino's pizza doesn't come on time, your war of illegal occupation comes for free. It's so ridiculous.
Let her finish this off. Here she goes. She hasn't said anything about Scud missiles yet, but I'm waiting. Hold on.
That's what we're talking about here. That's what Iran is actively supporting.
Well, I'll be. Nikki Haley, what she got for us there? Well, I want to tell Nikki that it's not the Iran nuclear deal. It's called the JCPA, or JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Adam, is it too much to ask that the United States ambassador to the UN could at least know the title of the so-called Iran nuclear deal?
No, that involves alphabets.
What is this show that we're watching here? Firstly, she pronounces terrorists like Bush does, terrorists.
Which would be an immediate red flag to anyone listening, first of all.
And she said regime with Iran, so she's already planted that stick down, regime. And so now Iran is supposedly backing all the terrorists in the Middle East. What groups is she talking about? What terrorists is Iran backing? The biggest backer of terrorists in the region is clearly Saudi Arabia, number one. Okay, from Nusra to ISIS across the board. Not only backing them, but actually they've got people in there as well. And so Saudi Arabia and its allies, the UAE, the United States itself, Israel, basically they've all got their hands completely filthy with Syria and Iraq, with ISIS, with Nusra, with all of them, okay, the U.S. and Britain and France, but especially Saudi Arabia. And they're trying to build this straw man. That's the only way I can describe it, Adam, that Iran is somehow behind the international issue of terrorism or problem. They're on the ground fighting ISIS, okay? If it was not for Iran, ISIS would have overran Iraq by now, in the most horrible way. The massacres would have mounted up in ways that you can't even imagine, if not for Iran intervening, supplying the Iraqi army with weapons, which they had none when ISIS came and did their major first wave in June of 2014. Iran came, helped them, and helped to arm and get the Hashd-e-Shaabi, the People's Mobilization Units, ready in Iraq. If not for Iran, Iraq would be an absolute war zone, a bloodbath, like worse than it was. And it was pretty bad, Adam. It would have been twice, three times as worse if not for Iran. Okay, and I don't even want to get into Syria because that's another conversation. But just for Iraq, so what on earth is this woman talking about? I really want to know.
And well, she's not only completely wrong about Iran and its non-existent links to terrorism, as you just explained, but there's a key point that a lot of people around Nikki Haley must be missing. They probably don't know what the word blockade means. In March of 2015, the Saudis began blockading Yemen with their ships, with their planes at the ready, and with the northern border on Yemen, and also Oman is essentially, it's closed its border to Yemen. So anything they say about Oman, nothing of any significance, certainly not from a sovereign state, can get in from Oman. Then in July of 2015, this JCPOA was agreed upon, which everyone, including the UN and many other countries, China, Russia, Germany, Britain, France, says they're obeying. There is no way that Iran could bring these missiles into Yemen without being seen by the Saudis and without being stopped. If UN-flagged ships that are carrying water and medicine can't get past the Saudi blockade, even with permission, does anyone out there honestly think that an Iranian warship bearing missiles could get through a blockade organized by their biggest regional foe? It's absolutely absurd. Even if Iran wanted to arm the Houthis, there's just no way that they could get past the blockade. Oh, God knows what missiles she was standing behind. A lot of ballistics experts have debunked that on its own merits, but the geopolitical reality is that Iran could not have got anything through to Yemen at the time that Nikki Haley is talking about, because Yemen is surrounded.
Yeah, that too. And let's put this in perspective a little bit. She's you know, if the Houthis squeezed off a couple of crude scuds, sort of giant Roman candles, and if they squeezed out a couple of those, so my attitude is, who cares? So what? They deserve to squeeze off more than that, because Saudi Arabia, with the United States arming it and the UK selling endless amount of weapons, like cashing checks like no one's ever seen before, the Saudi Arabian illegal undeclared war of aggression against Yemen has been the biggest boom for arms, the arms industry, it really the best thing on the planet right now. And so they've been carpet bombing Yemen now for almost 3 years. And what does that not get factored into her little moral threat matrix there, even a little bit? The tens of thousands of people dead?
The cholera epidemic, the worst human rights disaster of the 21st century, all man-made. Saudi men, American arms dealers, British, French arms dealers. These are the men and women who made this disaster.
Is this person who's supposed to be the United States of America's ambassador to the UN? Or is she that stupid to not be able to somehow weigh those on the scale of justice? Or is she completely ignorant of it? I literally think, Adam, that some of these American politicians, they get fed all the pieces of information and they literally don't know what's going on in the world. They're like horses at Kentucky Derby with blinders on. They are racehorses in a way. They are sort of pumped up to perform, and they don't do a whole lot. They just have a simple job. So you go from here and you go there. And then when you're done, do it again. That's kind of like what I'm thinking, because, or they just, these are, it's incomprehensible. It really is.
Well, absolutely. They fed this information, and in the same time, some of them would have at least spat some of it out. But when it comes to Nikki Haley, certainly she swallows it all in one big gulp, if you know what I mean.
I don't, actually. I don't. Don't go there.
Use their imagination.
Moving on swiftly. Moving on swiftly. I just want to add too that this is a huge distortion of the so-called intelligence that they're punting now on Iran. It's pretty much identical to what they did with Iraq in February of 2003. So she really kind of performed the Colin Powell ritual just there that we just saw there on the great network MSNBC. And so Iran, I'm going to repeat this, Iran is in total compliance with the international agreement. And so they have not violated, they're running a secret nuclear weapons program, okay? So this is not North Korea. This is Islamic Republic of Iran. This is a country is absolutely abiding by the terms of the deal. And so this is, I don't know what sort of war they're trying to line up here, but I'm sure, where do you think these marching orders are coming from, Adam?
Well, the marching orders in terms of Iran are coming from Israel, and you don't need to be an espionage to realize that. All you need to do is YouTube a speech, however recent or even distant, by Netanyahu, the Israeli regime leader, and then 2 minutes later, Google, YouTube, the same speech about Iran by Nikki Haley. They're using the same epithets, the same scare tactics, the same language about Iran. So it's really no mystery where the script is being written on this one.
And here's another story that came out, and you probably saw this too. And this is actually, this is kind of an important, potentially important story here. WikiLeaks, recognized as a media organization by a UK tribunal. So this the definition by the UK Information Tribunal may assist Julian Assange's defense against U.S. extradition on the grounds of press freedom. And this was a decision which was come to a couple of days ago. And so this is going to have a huge bearing, Adam, on the issue of whether Assange is to be considered a journalist and a publisher rather than what the U.S. is trying to categorize as a sort of what they call a non-state intelligence agency. This is the sort of from the creative department of the CIA. And so when they came out with this whole thing about calling WikiLeaks a non-state intelligence agency, there was a reason for that, Adam, is what I'm saying. It has everything to do with the legal status of Julian Assange, how one is labeled by this international cartel is very important because that determines what legal protections they can have and what legal protections they can't have. And so this is actually, I'm quite, encouraged by this decision, Adam.
It's certainly, on paper anyway, a very big step in the right direction. Mad Mike Pompeo, Donald Trump's CIA director, has more conspiracies about Julian Assange than the Flat Earth Society, which has branches all around the world, has about their issue du jour. But the problem is, if Pompeo's loony theories about Assange were to be actually executed, Assange could be extradited and literally executed in the U.S., as Hillary Clinton has salivated about many times. This new ruling, however, puts Pompeo on notice in the sense that the UK tribunal is saying, no, WikiLeaks, it's a journalistic media organization, nothing to do with espionage, nothing to do with intelligence. And that's, of course, an accurate statement. WikiLeaks doesn't go probing for information. What happens is people willingly leak the information that they, as whistleblowers, have uncovered, and WikiLeaks published it the way that frankly, any news organization ought to, but WikiLeaks, one, has the courage that others lack. Two, they don't have the corrupt corporate media industrial complex agenda that others have. And three, they are able to verify their sources far more accurately than the mainstream media, which has a hell of a lot more money. You read about all the retractions in the big establishment outlets from the New York Times to CNN, Washington Post, WikiLeaks has not had to retract a single story once. It's unheard of, but it's the absolute truth. And even the critics of WikiLeaks, with all of their weird theories and all their epithets, even they cannot challenge that crucial point. So this is very important, but I personally have lost a lot of faith in Western governments obeying their own laws. The First Amendment in the United States is a beautiful thing, but look at all of the things that they're doing to try to eliminate it. They're trying to pass legislation. I think some of the votes have already been won, saying that you can be held liable on criminal charges if you support the BDS movement, which has boycotted Israeli products, Israeli tourism, etc., until there's justice for Palestine. And they were, look what they did to one of my favorite musicians, Pink Floyd's Roger Waters, who just completed a tour of the US. They were trying to shut down his concerts because of the content of his speech, because of the things he said when he's not on stage, and because some of the things that go on during his concerts, all of which are covered by the First Amendment. And not only are they incredibly peaceful, but I think that they're incredibly useful in terms of using art for education. So Julian Assange isn't out of the woods yet, but it is an important step. One of the main, now that Sweden has essentially dropped everything against him, the main obstacle between Assange and getting on a plane to Ecuador, which has given him asylum, he's obviously in the embassy of Ecuador in London now, is the problem of this bail issue, that he skipped bail in England, and that the local police in London could arrest him, and then from there he's only one extradition order away from being in the same jail that Manning was in, only they probably would go after him even more than Manning, certainly if Pompeo and that lot had their way. In terms of the UK political situation, the current government is it's a disaster for Assange, as the last one was, but if Jeremy Corbyn, the opposition leader in the UK, gets in, and I don't know much about what he said about Assange because he's hardly said anything at all on the public record, but he certainly, Assange stands a better chance under a Corbyn government giving him some sort of clemency than the May government. And just to be clear, this clemency wouldn't be because Corbyn thinks Julian Assange is a great guy. It could be, it's because because the UN said that his detention is arbitrary and that it's cruel and that the only just solution is for him to be immediately released. And people are just ignoring that. The UK is ignoring that. Sweden and the EU ignored that. The US is ignoring that. But the Human Rights Commission said Assange must go, as in go out of the embassy. But of course, the only time America thinks someone should go is when it's a president of a sovereign country they don't agree with. We all remember the Assad must go. Well, let's change that to Assange must go, as in go to freedom.
Yeah, it to me, the most disappointing thing about the Julian Assange story is the amount of people on a certain side of the political left-right divide, the paradigm, because what was put out in WikiLeaks was perceived to have grossly damaged the campaign of Hillary Rodham Clinton. A lot of liberals, people who call themselves progressive liberals, consider him a kind of like a international criminal, or some sort of like a spy or guilty of treason, which is impossible because he's not a U.S. citizen. So I don't know what country he's guilty of treason against. But it's very disappointing because all of the information which was published was true, and so. I believe it was leaked by someone in the DNC, and I think it's somebody who got shot and killed in the street in cold blood in Washington D.C. last year. Possibly a good chance to, in my mind anyway, that they leaked that information to somebody, to a middleman who then handed it to WikiLeaks, and it wasn't Russian hackers, as the sort of narrative goes. But that's kind of disappointing because, you know, if he did the same thing for Trump, against Trump, in the next election, someone comes with a whole pile of stuff exposing Trump's corruption with Israel or whatever, those same people who are calling him an international criminal will be cheering for him. If what he publishes is used to bring down the Trump administration, which is just a total people being hypocrites, Adam. And so where are people's principles in politics is maybe my question here. I thought the left was supposed to represent this sort of higher moral standard than the right or the so-called conservatives or neoconservatives. But it seems to me, Adam, that when it comes to the crunch, people are willing to sell out for a few bags of silver, depending on which way the wind's blowing and which political direction the wind's blowing. That's
absolutely. The Republicans and the Democrats are equally unprincipled, as are most of the mainstream so-called left, so-called right parties throughout the Western world, Europe, Canada, Australia, etc. People really ought to remember that when Assange and WikiLeaks burst onto the scene, it was during the Bush years. He was a darling of the so-called liberal left, who didn't like George Bush, not because he killed a million Iraqis, but because he said terror, which shows you what they value. Then when Obama comes in and does the same stuff as Bush, only more of it, Assange becomes a villain. And it was only when he went after Hillary Clinton, who's about as progressive as Augusto Pinochet at a firing range with Margaret Thatcher after a vampire lookalike contest, Assange went from the villain to the supervillain. Now, if he continues, as you say, to expose Trump's collusion with the foreign power, because his administration and people on his transition team certainly were, and it seems are, colluding with the foreign power, and that power is called Israel, never has been, or likely ever will be, Russia, I'd love to see the information that WikiLeaks may be able to produce. The only problem there is that colluding with Israel is good if you're a mainstream US politician or unthinking a mainstream media consumer. So all this stuff we heard about foreign collusion when they thought about Russia, and people were talking about the Logan Act, which now everyone and their brothers an expert on, even though 10 months ago no one had even heard of the Logan Act. All of a sudden, when things are on the other side, and when there actually is foreign collusion exposed with Israel, as it already has been, when it turned out that Netanyahu personally contacted members of the Trump transition team, almost certainly Jared Kushner, who is of course Ivanka Trump's husband. Nepotism ain't what it used to be. Or is it? And he essentially said, not only do we want you as the U.S. to have a certain policy, but we want you to convince other countries, including Russia, to change their foreign policy. So the real scandal of foreign collusion in the United States is Israel manipulating U.S. policy and trying to get the U.S. to act as the middleman for Israel in manipulating the foreign policy of other countries. The only people involved in this, in from the Russian side, was the former Ambassador Kislyak, who listened to the whole thing and said more or less, thanks but no thanks. So Russiagate is Israelgate. Much as I loved the WikiLeaks publications on corrupt, crooked, horrible, killer Hillary Clinton, I'd love to see more such publications about Trump. But will it matter in a country where Israel can do no wrong in the eyes of the elite, who, whether you're Republican or Democrat, whether you love guns and hate abortion, or you love gay rights and hate, Alabama and Texas, they're all sitting there together drinking the same Israeli wine, Israeli food at the AIPAC dinners and these other lobbying groups. It really is a sham. They give people bread and circuses arguing about social issues, which frankly are state issues constitutionally anyway, and then on the foreign policy matters where the federal government should have some say, they're all essentially bowing before the same altar, and that's Israel.
And I'll just underline what you said, that the whole Michael Flynn story, where Flynn has been snared in this Russian collusion narrative, what actually happened, Jared Kushner was dispatched to basically give Flynn orders to go and lobby to other members of the UN Security Council. This was during the transition period before the inauguration, to get them basically to influence their vote on the UN voting to sort of put a halt to illegal settlements by Israel in the West Bank. And so that's beyond collusion. That is basically Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of the president, acting as an agent of a foreign country, by definition, without a doubt, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts, and you can zigzag all you want around that, but it's the fact. And so this is beyond collusion. So nothing happened with Russia, and here we have a foreign country going in, literally manipulating, using a member of the incoming administration's team, National Security Advisor, former retired General Michael Flynn, in order to sort of patch up votes in a UN vote on behalf of Israel that is completely in contravention of so many other UN previous resolutions. I mean, that's coming straight from Netanyahu's office to Kushner. So this is a compromised administration on so many levels, but it's a compromised government. Washington is compromised in this, and the media say nothing. They've zipped it. It's all Russia, Russia, Russia. No, Russiagate, like you said, Adam, Russiagate is Israelgate. And that is the big elephant in the room. And it's just kind of obvious. And if not for a few media outlets who brought this up, most people, even who do know about it, wouldn't know about it.
And to make matters even worse, there's a video on YouTube of a man called Chaim Saban, who's a big entrepreneur. He did a lot of television shows like Power Rangers and all of that sort of thing. And he's there at a pro-Israel meeting in D.C., I believe it's D.C., with Kushner sitting next to him. And he's there joking about it. He said, I know some people are giving you a hard time, but I think what you did was great. I don't think it's illegal. Understatement of the century, or is it the overstatement? I'm not a lawyer. and they're just cheering it on. Now, imagine if someone, and this guy, by the way, Saban, is a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, who was a Hillary Clinton supporter, but who once said Israel is the only thing that matters. So there's your choice and your democracy for you. But could you just imagine if it was someone who was part of the Trump transition team sitting next to someone at a pro-Russia dinner, not that there are any in D.C., but let's just pretend. And he said, I know that you colluded a bit with Russia, but I think it's A-OK and you did a fantastic job. CNN would probably be running that story for the next 30 years.
Oh, they would. And by the way, what's ironic about this was that they have stitched up Michael Flynn, and he was the one who basically went and did the dirty work for Kushner, which is his mistake, and I'm sure he's probably regretting that.
He was the patsy, more or less.
He was set up. Michael Flynn was totally set up. Now we know. Of course, we know that, but most of the U.S. media doesn't know. By the way, that's a scary image that you illustrated there with Augusta Pinochet and Margaret Thatcher. That's pretty scary. That's
like, I know, it's not Halloween, it's Christmas. I should watch my references.
That's like the nightmare pheasant shoot up in the up at Balmoral or something like that. That's the worst possible pheasant shoot. But anyway... we're going to take a short break. I'm here with Adam Gary from the Duran, and we haven't even got into hardcore Russia mania. And we're going to talk about the world's most interesting man after the break, and it will be very interesting, I assure you. I'm here, host Patrick Henningsen. This is the Sunday Wire. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
Tired of boring, stupid podcasts? I know I am. If you want something different, check out Jay's Analysis and Esoteric Hollywood only on the Alternate Current Radio Network. The biggest breakdowns of the biggest films, geopolitics, esoterica, and theology. I've been thinking too much about you.
Hi, I'm Patrick Henningsen, host of the Sunday Wire, and you are listening to the Alternate Current Radio Network.
His personality is so magnetic, he is unable to carry credit cards. Even his enemies list him as their emergency contact number. He never says something tastes like chicken, not even chicken. He is the most interesting man in the world.
I don't always drink beer, but when I do, I prefer Dos Equis. Stay thirsty, my friends.
Welcome back to the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live on the Alternate Current Radio Network and also at 21stCenturyWire.com. Thank you, everybody, for rejoining us for this fantastic Sunday live broadcast, episode 214. Christmas is just around the corner, and I'm here with a special guest, Editor Duran. His name is Adam Gary. He's joining us on the live link from nice Christmassy holiday London right now, enjoying the run-up to Christmas. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Patrick. Great to be with you still.
And, you know, of all the things that you have to worry about over the holidays, we'll just add another one here. This is from The Guardian. This is from Ewan McCaskill, who is the defense correspondent, who's got a Russia story here. I love this term, Adam, defense correspondent. First of all, this whole term defense is so Orwellian. It's unbelievable. Nobody's going to invade Britain, right? Not anytime soon, as far as I know, unless they're coming on the Channel Tunnel. So defense correspondent. What an industry that's been created now. We have the Russia experts, defense experts, and I'm reading this story by The Guardian, which I'll read in a minute. It was a total howler. You too could be a Russia expert, Adam. If you play your cards right, you could be the BBC's go-to guy on Russia.
Well, a couple problems with that. First of all, I don't have a pathological hatred for Russia. And secondly, I know about Russia beyond mere anecdotes, lies, and fantastical sequences that are on the cutting room floor of the Dr. Strangelove editing suite. So for those two reasons alone, I'm immediately disqualified from being a BBC Russia expert. But if I learned how to launder money and spend time with Russians running away from criminal prosecutions in the more expensive parts of London, maybe, just maybe, I could get there.
Yeah, you're not going to be giving us the old Borisovsky narrative. So no jobs for you at Sky or the BBC for the foreseeable future. But at The Guardian here, Russia could cut off internet cables to NATO countries, warns British military chief. This is Air Chief Marshal Peach. Love the name. Says Russian ships have been spotted. Listen to this. Spotted close to the Atlantic that carry cables between the U.S. and Europe. And of course, there's nothing that's more scary for people in the 21st century, Adam, that maybe their internet might get cut off. And lo and behold, who would do such a dastardly deed? But none other than the man himself, the man behind everything, Vladimir Putin, all-seeing, omnipotent, and all-pervasive. He's everywhere. And apparently, could be a hunt for Red October here, says Sir Stuart Peach is warning about this. I'm just going to say, Adam, this is the second time they've recycled the story, the exact same story they ran in October 2015. What would it take to cut U.S. data cables and halt internet access? Russian submarines, they said, and spy chiefs are worried about the possibility of, and this was, again, it's a great Christmas story, Adam. Russia could cut off internet access, and then we wouldn't be able to get those deals on Amazon, would we?
Oh, boy, that's too scary. I don't even want to think about that. All I can say is, in 1992, the band Van Halen did a video for the song Right Now, and they had little cartoon captions as the music was playing. One of the things is, right now our government is doing things that we only think other governments do. And that's exactly what this story is. The U.S. Congress just killed what's called net neutrality in the U.S., meaning service providers, whether it's your Comcast, your Time Warners, whatever, can now determine which websites get censored, which don't, which websites are sped up, which websites are slowed down. It's censorship through the corporate back door. But instead of reporting about that very important story, instead, picture Putin in a scuba diving outfit with the aqualung and the mask and the whole thing, swimming down to the bottom of the Atlantic. Oh, look, there's the Titanic and, you know, images of DiCaprio. And then once you get a bit deeper, imagine him with a giant pair of scissors cutting the internet. Because this story, which would make the writers of Doctor Strange blush, is what's being promoted. While the real story that could endanger the internet as we've come to know it, a piece of legislation which just got voted up in the U.S. Congress, that's been totally suppressed.
And by the way, guess who invented this original story in 2015? One of the original source that I can find of this Red October internet cable story is, guess who? The New York Times. Mm.
I was going to say Al Gore, because he invented the internet itself, but New York Times, not. That's a close second.
Well, Al Gore is, he's busy heating up the Earth's atmosphere with all his rhetoric, but and other things too. So don't even want to go there. But anyway, moving on swiftly. So, you know, so New York Times. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and you know, we'll get to the world's most interesting man in a minute. But before that, I did a episode of Crosstalk on RT this past week, and you know, you've been on this show quite a few times, Adam. You're a regular fixture on this sort of, especially the kind of extended bullhorns segment, which usually goes on Sunday or Monday, and so you know it's a totally unscripted show, right? There's nothing on the cutting room floor, pretty much, right? It's what you see is what you
what you see as it's filmed is what goes out. That's it. Very, very raw.
Yeah, it's just, so I was doing this. She said, "Well, we're doing a thing on the media and fake news, and if I can make it, I will never miss that topic because I have done so much research on it, and I know this topic so well, and it directly affects what we do at 21st Century Wire, and it affects people that work on stories and do investigations with, like Vanessa Beely, and it affects other people that we all know and work with, and you also at the Duran are affected by this too, because independent outlets like us are labeled as fake news by a mediocre and quite frankly ridiculous academics in America that are taking partisan stances against people who are not attacking Russia or attacking Trump, calling us fake news or conspiracy outlets. So I take it personally. It's just kind of an issue, being called a Kremlin agent or something like this publicly by people. So it's, yeah, I get passionate about this topic, and I know what a fraud the whole thing is. But there are some people, surprisingly, Adam, that don't know what a fraud is. So Peter Lavelle is the host, who's kind of like, to me, a boxing referee. He reminds me, and even more so now, he reminds me of an old school boxing referee with the bow tie. He is totally like the old school boxing referees, you know, the big fights in Atlantic City with, like, you know, Cassius Clay and George Foreman or whoever. And so Peter's kind of a referee of sorts. It's a tough balancing act to host a show like that, but obviously if you do it long enough, you become good at it. But Peter's kind of a different kind of referee, because in some of the fights, he actually gets in and starts punching as well. So imagine
he's not afraid to get stuck in, and that's when it gets really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. So imagine a boxing match where the referee starts hitting, throwing rabbit punches and stuff. So, I mean, this is, so Peter's involved in the conversation, basically. And so who did they team up for this show on Tuesday or Wednesday? So I got the call. And usually you don't know who's going to be on the show because until you get the introductions before the recording starts, and I can't see anything. I don't have a monitor. I just have an earpiece in one ear. And that's it, basically. Yeah. And the rest is in your mind, in your imagination. They said, okay, Patrick, say hi to Lionel. And I was like, oh, my God, it's Lionel. So I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. So, hi, Lionel. How you doing? Lionel's in New York, Lionel Media. And he himself is a lawyer. And there I am with Lionel. And then the next guy comes on. We thought Peter thought he was going to bail because he was late. And it was none other than, believe it or not, I was surprised. Eric Alterman. And people say, well, who's Eric Alterman? Well, Eric Alterman is a senior fellow at John Podesta's Center for American Progress think tank. Okay? Not only that, but he is basically the court stenographer for the Obama administration. And he's written a number of books for the Democratic Party. They're all partisan, called completely. A total liberal progressive standard bearer. And a professor of journalism at SUNY, the State University of New York, at the campus in Brooklyn. And he apparently wrote the book on presidential lying. And so it's about Bush, basically. So obviously no Democratic presence in there. I wasn't shy to point that out during this discussion. But he comes right out of the gates, Adam. I've never seen anything like it. So Lionel goes first, and then Peter goes to this guy, Eric. And he comes right out of the gates and basically slags everybody off, saying, I don't believe a word of what was said on this show. And then it just went haywire from there, Adam. I was like, I felt like I was in a bar fight by the end of it. As close as you could get from being in a remote studio debating with three other people, it was kind of draining. It was difficult. It was a very difficult episode, actually, but apparently it generated some memorable moments that have been serialized online. And a big shout out to Creative Accidents, who's one of the ACR core crew members there. He's probably in the chat room right now, and he put a meme out which Lionel actually used on his Facebook page as the background image now, which had emojis laughing, and then it had one emoji who was crying, and that was this guy Eric. Go ahead, and I'm gonna roll this clip, and this is Peter going over to Eric here. This is Lionel setting it up, basically, and then it goes to Eric Alterman. And basically, I kind of burst out laughing when he made the statement, Adam. He said something like, "Well, the media never lie on purpose; they just make mistakes." And I just burst out laughing. I didn't realize that Peter and Lionel were laughing at the same time. So when it came out on TV, it just was like, it was like the Hollywood Squares. You know, it's like totally mess, just a total train wreck. I mean, anyway, I feel bad for this guy, actually. He wasn't enjoying himself, clearly. But here, roll this. Listen to this.
Fact that today's mainstream media, today's Ted Baxter, sock puppet, echo chamber, rancid, odios, ossified media is dead. It's through. It's in the death throes, and it faces an existential threat. That's their problem. And you think they'd be shaping up instead of becoming that's more, a really and good, more negligent.
Eric, let me go to you. That's a very good point to mention. I mean, they should get their act together. But you know, we had still don't know why three different outlets confirmed the same bogus Russia story last week. They just had a retraction or an update. But they didn't explain to the public how they came to that disastrous conclusion across the board. I mean, no wonder people don't trust the media anymore. They're not transparent. Go ahead, Eric.
I find everything I've heard said on this program so far to be ridiculous. I think the mainstream media are, first of all, the word media is a plural noun. So to talk about the media, you have to make distinctions between which media you're discussing. I think the media you mean, which is CNN, the New York Times, Washington Post, etc., I think they're in an impossible position because they are faced with a president who lies on average six times a day. That's a statistic compiled by the Washington Post. He probably lies much more than that.
Okay, just Adam, that's a classic straw man argument, right? So he just, rather than answering the question, he built a straw man, which has nothing to do with the actual question, in order to sort of deflect and kind of divert the conversation over in another direction. So that's pretty amazing out of the gates. Here we go.
But those are the lies they've caught using a very narrow definition of lies.
So the mainstream media doesn't lie? The mainstream media doesn't lie? Is that what you're saying?
First of all, we're talking... Well, I'm pretty capable of saying exactly what I want, so you don't have to put words in my mouth.
Well, I'm trying to understand your words,
Fox News lies, but no, the mainstream media by and large, certainly the New York Times, Washington Post, and other reputable outlets never lie on purpose. They make mistakes. But it's very hard to cover a president who is purposely undermining.
that was the moment there. We just all spontaneously burst out laughing. And mind you, we can't see each other. There's no monitors. I think the only person that has a monitor would be Peter in Moscow, right?
That's certainly how it is when I do it. I'm just staring into the oblivious camera.
Yeah, so here we go. Listen to the rest of this as he tries to recover from this.
American democracy, who, again, lies on average six times a day and doesn't care that he's caught lying. Let me ask you a question. Just take one for instance. Donald Trump repeatedly tweeted that Barack Obama wiretapped him on purpose. Now, the Justice Department found that was not true.
Has there seems to be overwhelming evidence that he was surveilled. He was surveilled.
I'm not done.
Okay.
No, there's no evidence.
I said before this program, I don't want to have any filibustering.
Let me finish one more
because
sentence.
I believe in freedom
I'm
of speech.
And
okay. So Adam, what before the show started, Peter said before the recording, he said, right, please, no filibustering. And this guy just went on to filibuster on a straw man point. It's unbelievable. So I don't know what to say. Anyway, Peter made a good point there, Adam, which you probably be aware of too, which is that I think it was Susan Rice that was involved in the surveillance of the Trump transition team. And so that was going on under Obama's watch. There was, call it wiretapping, call it surveillance, doesn't matter. It's the same thing. It's surveillance. So Peter made a good point there, which is amazing.
I would like to hear the freedom of speech from Patrick in Plymouth. Go ahead, Patrick. React to what you've heard so far.
Yeah. First of all, I'm gonna disagree with what Eric said about defining the terms. I'm going to say media as a singular entity, because when it comes to all things Russian,
it's grammatically
or all things
incorrect.
Trump, the media, it might.
You see, so Adam, I was trying to basically dispense with the semantic point to make a conceptual point, and he came to me like a junior high English teacher and said, "No, it's a plural noun. It's a plural noun. You can't use is media is."
And I would have said more like the annoying kid in the front row who gets a very severe encounter after the bell rings. But you're being far more charitable.
Yeah, 3 o'clock high, 3 o'clock high, meet you out in the playground, 3 o'clock. But so I was trying to make a conceptual point that the media kind of is in lockstep on certain issues, and he wouldn't let me finish to let me make my creative non-semantic point, but here we go.
Be grammatically incorrect, but it does represent the reality of the situation, which is that media is completely together in lockstep, reading off the same hymn sheet on all things Russian. And if you want to talk about the mainstream media, these are all fake news stories from mainstream media. This is just my file for the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN. Granted, CNN's half of this, but this is perhaps my favorite. Pokemon Go was hijacked by Vladimir Putin to mislead Americans. This is a CNN exclusive. This is just one example of many. And to say that what you're doing, Eric, is creating a false equivalency. Trying to compare Donald Trump's Twitter tirades to what's supposed to be the Fourth Estate, who has a collective budget, operating budget, of over $10 million billion dollars in the United States, all of these mainstream media outlets basically putting out fake news. The CNN WikiLeaks story is quite interesting because the same so-called sources were used apparently by CBS News as well as CNN and others. And you read the email and you could see the date. It was September 14th. So I had the question is, you know, were these, did these sources actually read the so-called evidence, or should it have been done in Braille? Or the CNN's journalists, so-called journalists, are they illiterate? How does this type of mistake come to be? And how is it repeated and passed on to other, laundered through CNN and then on to CBS? CNN uses
Twitter. So the point I was making, Adam, is that CNN now uses Twitter. They say Trump is putting fake news on Twitter. CNN tweets stuff out that they end up having to retract. But by the time they do that, they've, you know, spread the story like wildfire. And so in this case, it was Manu Raju, was CNN's reporter, that sort of put this howler out, and they all sort of went for it like they do in all these stories. Washington Post does the same thing as well. And so by that time, the thing is out, and it was just the most extraordinary piece of fake news, because you're looking at the email, which is partially redacted, but the date there says, they said this was put out September 4th, that Trump had access to WikiLeaks before it was made public, and here's the evidence. And you look at the date, Adam, and it's September 14th. It was after this stuff was already out on the internet, so it wasn't like top secret or anything, but they thought they had the ultimate exclusive, Adam. It was just unbelievable. I mean, you have to look at that. And forget about the Pokemon story, because that's just ridiculous. But that means you shouldn't take CNN seriously as a news organization, the most trusted name in news. The WikiLeaks story is a perfect example. This is not journalism. This is not media. This is, what is this? This is like this is bad propaganda. It's not even good propaganda anymore. It's like, it's really bad dysfunctional propaganda, Adam.
It's exactly that, because good propaganda at least has some element of conceivability to it, and good propaganda can only work if it seems airtight in terms of its presentation, if it seems that it's presented in such a way that it would be difficult to immediately refute. The CNN bogus that they're putting out is not only easily refutable, but it's instantly refutable. Just look at the date stamp on that particular WikiLeaks document that you were talking about. It's also so hysterical that it's as though they're just waiting, salivating, trying to find the next story. And like with Bush, like with Obama, like with Trump, I'm extremely critical. I went from being cautiously optimistic about Trump to being comfortably pessimistic. There's a lot to criticize. You don't need to resort to lies. The truth is really, really good. With Kushner colluding with Israel, committing an act which could be treasonous. I certainly think it ought to be classed as that. When we have Trump launching airstrikes against Syria, which was not only illegal, but totally counterproductive, threatening North Korea, threatening Iran. There's plenty of material, but what does CNN do? They go off to the most inane, asinine, little point-scoring exercises based on total lies. And I used to think, this time, if you asked me this time last year, I thought, if we can all just put up with 3 months of this, CNN won't ever be honest, they won't ever give you the real important stories, because they never did. But at least this kind of immature sort of schoolyard point scoring would give way to, you know, the kinder, gentler, more mild fake news that they were giving out prior to the arrival of Donald Trump on the political scene. Now I think that's not going to happen. I think that CNN and organizations that follow this agenda are just going to get more and more absurd. Because once you've broken that threshold, where is there to go? Unless you totally rebrand yourself with totally new on-air stuff, there's nowhere to go but further down. They're going to chase rock bottom till they try to find something that sticks. And right now, unless you're in that media bubble where you believe what these people say, and there's fewer and fewer people that do, this just just nowhere to go but further down.
Yeah, I can't imagine how much more of this that. And I asked this to Mike Robinson from the UK column last on Monday's show, and I said, Mike, you know, have they always been this stupid, or are we just is Russia making them stupid? In other words, like Trump has induced this sort of collective mass hysteria.
Putin has a mass stupefier machine. That must be it.
And so is it that the Russian story has just triggered this kind of total hysterical? I called it a hysterical insurgency in the mainstream media. That I don't believe that the mainstream media is a liberal media. I think it's liberal, it's conservative, it's pro-military, it's pro-Israel, whatever, you know, whatever flavor or shape it takes for whatever story. It's about protecting establishment interests, whichever those interests are. But there seems to be this collective lobotomization that's taken place. It's like a voluntary lobotomization where, I mean, are these all the most incompetent, stupid people that they have hired, and they pay them seven? So Manu Raju is on at least $600,000 a year. That would be like the low end for like a CNN junior anchor. It'd be like $600K, maybe $700K. Brian Stelter, who's like the name of his show is Reliable Sources, what a laugh. And he was commenting on this, on defending it on Twitter, and I'm like, you're the host of Reliable Sources. Anyway, so if Adam, you know, you and I deal with information on a daily basis, okay, and some of it's quite complex, and sometimes it takes a lot of work to figure out what exactly you're looking at, right, and to put it into context. So, but if someone's paying you $700,000 a year or $1 million a year, Adam, are you going to get it right? Are you going to get it wrong? How many times can you get it wrong on $1 million a year? I mean, let's be honest.
Especially when it comes to matters that are so simple. These aren't questions of analyzing the various factions in the multifactional conflict in Yemen. This is about, did a guy say what we said he said? And if so, did he say it round about when we said that he said it? And they're still getting it totally wrong.
Yeah, so it is amazing. Looking at Russiagate, I mean, the whole thing is, and I said this on the air too, on the show, and I'll keep saying it, 18 months, 24/7, on every major U.S. outlet, every newspaper, every TV show, off the rolling off the tongues of every politician, is this a total fake, fabricated news cycle narrative of Russia meddling, Russia influencing, Russia hacking, whatever. It's been a year and a half. And at what point do people say, right, there's no evidence, so can we abandon this now? And it's doing so much damage to bilateral relations between the U.S., of course, by design. There's some people that are profiting off that, of course. But at what point do these people in the media abandon this sinking, this Titanic, Adam? This is like the Titanic hoax of all time. And they just keep laying it on and laying it on in the Adam Schiff's of the world. And at what point are people going to say, right, okay, that's it, it's over? But or has the U.S., Adam, become like Stalin's Soviet Union in terms of media coverage, where no one actually, well, people do believe it, or the people working in media, they can't possibly believe this, but they're going on with the charade. I don't know what it is, Adam. It's extraordinary. None of it's true. The 17 agencies claim it's not. That's not true. That's a total debunked lie. And people are shaming people for, how can you doubt the intelligence, the men and women who serve and put their lives on the line for this country? And how can you doubt their findings on Russian meddling? And how dare the president question the intelligence community, the IC, you know, the 17 agencies? It wasn't 17 agencies. It was only a couple agencies, and they handpicked the analysts to come up with that specific conclusion. So there's no consensus among the so-called U.S. intelligence community. It's a total, the whole thing is a fraud, Adam.
Absolutely. And I personally, I like your reference to Soviet media, but I want to go much more recent than the Stalin era. Let's go to the 1980s. In the 1980s, the average Soviet citizen didn't believe their media when they said things like food will become more plentiful, we're going to have a bigger harvest. On the domestic side, they were skeptical. Naturally, that skepticism eventually translated into Soviet media reports about foreign countries. At the turn of the 1990s, a lot of Soviet citizens who didn't know a great deal and had no first-hand experience in places like West Germany, France, United States, Britain, they thought these were countries that were clean, full employment, where luxury goods were more or less the de facto standard of 80% of the population, and all the politicians were fairly honest and democratic. When the Soviet Union collapsed, they found out that while they still realized that their government was lying about the internal situation, that ironically, they were telling the truth about foreign countries by and large. The U.S. is engaging in imperial wars and lying about why they're going in. Unemployment is a massive problem in capitalist societies. Homelessness in cities, whether New York, Detroit, London, Marseille, these are real problems. And so what does give me hope is that people in the West will learn more about people, countries on the other side, which is a term I dislike. The Cold War is over. There are now many sides. But I hope that people will eventually use the power of the internet while they still can and find out more about what other people are saying and what they're experiencing. And I think in many ways this has already worked in Syria, certainly. In Syria, you've got people that are Syrian citizens in Syria blogging, making video reports, taking raw footage of what's going on around them. And this has allowed people in the West to say the government isn't telling the truth about Syria. Assad is the person who's struggling to keep a country together where a Muslim shop is next to a Christian church and people are friends with one another, no matter if they're Shia, Sunni, Catholic, Orthodox, what Druze, Arab, Kurd, whatever. And I think that if this model is extrapolated more widely, and in many ways with Russia it already is, the people in Russia aren't living in this kind of kooky James Bond meets Austin Powers dictatorship that people, that CNN and others like it would have you believe. People in Russia generally have the same complaints as everyone. The weather's too cold, the price of such and such is too high, my boss is a jerk. But in terms of people sort of running from government government agents that are just gunning people down who may have complained about their government, the ironic thing is that Russians actually complain about their own government far more than the average person in the West, especially nowadays. If you complain about the government, you're anti-American. We're back in the McCarthy era. If you say something good about RT, let alone on RT in Europe, you're some sort of communist agent, even if you're neither a communist nor an agent of anything. Where in Russia, people are very vocal, certainly at a cultural level. Russian people don't hold back their criticism, whether for their government or for another. So my hope, frankly, is that what happened in the late Soviet period will happen in the West, and people will see that once you're exposed to what's going on in other countries, you'll realize your governments and your media, who are frankly the same thing at this point, are lying about it. They're just lying about the whole thing, and the lies aren't even creative. They aren't even interesting. They're starting to get annoying.
And hope is on the way, Adam. Don't you worry. Pope Francis has announced, he says that journalists commit sins of communication. So the Pope has, the Pontiff has weighed in on this issue of freedom of the press as he delivered his sermon to journalists, a group of journalists on Saturday. And basically an NPR reporter was there. Thanks for that, our U.S. taxpayer money at work there. So NPR was on the scene. And so who were there? So the Pope made comments to members of the Italian Periodical Press Union. For Americans and other people, periodical means magazine, for those of you who are post-internet. So the Italian Federation of Catholic Weeklies reported this meeting, and according to the Pope, journalism is a field dominated by the anxiety of speed and is driven by sensationalism. an apt observation there by the pontiff, by His Eminence. Reliable information, he said, is at a premium. Don't you know it, Mr. Pope? Don't you know it? So Pope Francis also spoke about the perils of disinformation and slander. And nowhere has he said, I can't find it, it's fake news. The Pope did not use the term fake news, as far as I could see, unless they just haven't translated it in this. But it's pretty amazing. So even the Pope is getting involved here. So God, one step away from God himself, is involved in the fake news debate, essentially. So I think this could be a good thing. A little bit of morals injected into media, into the media industry, the mainstream media industry. That's not a bad thing, is it, Adam?
No, it certainly would be a good thing for the media to have, not morals, and frankly, even rolling it one step back, just basic ethics. I think the speed in modern media, in terms of the speed of getting information out, is a good thing. And if people are worried that the information may not be accurate, all it takes is the simple word unverified or unconfirmed to show that you're being honest with your readers or viewers and saying, this is what we have so far, but it's not rock solid, it's just come out. CNN doesn't do that sort of thing when they should. And all it takes is those one or two simple words to communicate that. As for the sensationalism, absolutely. To me, it really all comes down to issues of war and peace. And when the United States is lying about what people should be afraid of, and when they're hiding things that really do matter, such as why is America giving weapons to a Saudi regime causing a total crisis in Yemen? Why is Israel and the United States behind supporting and propping up Takfiri jihadists in Syria when they should be supporting a secular government whose constitution stresses the tolerance between people and stresses a sense of civic unity above sectarianism? These are the whys and ifs and wheres that we should be hearing, but instead it's just more and more of the same nonsense from the usual suspects.
Yep, exactly. And I could interject a few key points in there, but because it's the holidays, we're going to move on to an interesting story now. Let's look at the profile of what I consider, Adam, is the new version, is the new archetype of the world's most interesting man. I'm talking about a geopolitical carpetbagger extraordinaire international. And his name, he's the former president of the Republic of Georgia of Rose Revolution fame. His name is Mikhail Saakashvili. Yes, former New York lawyer turned head of state in Georgia, and the nemesis, in his mind anyway, of Vladimir Putin. Here's a guy, okay, here's a guy that was pretty much down on his luck. So he was put on a magic carpet by John McCain and George Soros, and he rode that carpet right into the presidency in Tbilisi in 2003 in the glorious Rose Revolution, the first really the first proper color revolution, I would say. I don't know if you agree with me on that.
Yeah, but I would.
Marketed, packaged, the whole thing. And so there he goes into power, and then the dirt wasn't even on the rug in the presidential palace before they're already positioning some sort of confrontation with Russia over the breakaway republics of Georgia, South Ossetia, and Abkhazia. And so Saakashvili was there taking the weapons from NATO, taking the Israeli military advisors, stocking up the ranks of his, building this military in this little country of Georgia, which is really the soft underbelly of the Russian Federation. So in Brzezinski and Mackinder terms, this is the key node in the sort of Eurasian Balkan equation, is Georgia, without a doubt. Okay, and so there's this guy, and I look at his pedigree, Adam. Amazingly, so he went to Columbia Law School and then went to take classes at George Washington University. This is in the mid-90s. He's not very old. He's sort of he's my age, or he's in sort of like, mid to late 40s now. But as a young buck, would he have been tapped by the CIA at one of their two most fertile recruitment grounds, which are Columbia University, and where Obama went, by the way, and George Washington University. And so here's this lawyer, and he's down on his luck. He's been kicked out of his own country. They put corruption charges on him a few years ago. He had to renounce his citizenship of Georgia in order to avoid extradition. And he's sitting in a bar, Adam, in Brooklyn, and he's being forced to turn tricks for CNN as a guest pundit for, I don't know, $500 a shot or whatever. It's so here he is, and then all of a sudden he gets a tap on his shoulder, Adam, and they said, Mikhail, we've got a gig for you. And he's sitting there in this bar in Brooklyn with his, and there's a picture of it on our show page right now, and he's got his palm, his face palming it. He's got a pint there. We've got a picture of Putin pouring him tea over the bar, actually. It's a really nice little photo illustration. But and he gets the call to go to the Ukraine and become governor of Odessa. And I can't for the life of me guess why the U.S. installed Putsch government in Kiev would take this guy on, this carpetbagger. And I still couldn't for the longest time figure out what he was doing there. And I kind of worked out that it was probably John McCain that installed him there. So they called Poroshenko in Kiev, probably said, look, you got to get this guy a job. We'd like him in Odessa. Okay, yes, sir, yes, sir. Three bags full, sir. And that was that. Now, we're going to talk about that. But I'm going to play you this clip, Adam. This is when he was basically excommunicated. He got kicked out of the Ukraine, and then he fought his way back into the country this fall. It's the most amazing story ever in geopolitics for one man, the most interesting man in the world. Here he is on CNN, basically setting up his return to the Ukraine. Here it is.
Literally gone to war with Vladimir Putin. Yes, Mr. President, great to see you again. Thank you
for bringing me back. By the way, I have to say that Russia also said that they also want me dead. So I'm on
right,
that
exactly.
List.
You and Bill Browder, unfortunately, are very similar in that regard. I was actually going to say that. Mr. Browder today, he clearly made a connection between, he said there's a clear connection to Putin from this meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and Natalia Veselnitskaya that happened in Trump Tower during the election. Do you think that meeting was a Russian intelligence operation?
Well, I think Russians are operating in all different directions. That's a surprise to me. Overall, I just take my word that nothing serious was done in that meeting. I don't think serious business would be done in such a short meeting overall. But, of course, Russia has been trying very hard. They've been meddling into elections. They've started to meddle into elections in my own country, Georgia. Of course, they've been meddling all around the world, and I would be very surprised if they had not been trying to in the U.S.
So Adam, it's amazing. So CNN was using him to sort of prop up the Russian hacking elections narrative, basically. And so there's this guy. He's totally stateless. He's been stripped. So basically, he got parachuted into, kicked out of his own country after being president, had to give up his citizenship, gets parachuted into the Ukraine, and given Ukrainian citizenship to be governor of Odessa, ends up getting in a corruption scandal there. They strip Poroshenko, the man who brought him in, takes his Ukrainian citizenship away, kicks him out of the country. He's turning tricks for CNN in Brooklyn. And then he forces his way over the border of Poland and Western Ukraine with a mob of his supporters physically forcing his way into the country, and then announces he wants to overthrow the government in Kiev. And then they take him to court. His supporters bust him out of the police van. The police recapture him a couple of day later or 2 days later. They have him in custody. He goes onto the roof of a building, threatens that he's going to jump. And he's going to jump if they don't release him for crying about his human rights, threatens to go on hunger strike. Then the judge releases him on like pretty much no bail, basically. And I'm thinking the U.S. has to be involved in this. This guy, there is a purpose for this man in the Ukraine, Adam. What is this purpose? That's the question.
Well, the most interesting thing of the many interesting things about this story is, well, there's two things. First of all, everything that's happened in Ukraine since 2014 is what happened in Georgia under Saakashvili. So you had a leader in Georgia, Edvard Shevardnadze, who was much like Poroshenko's regime's predecessor, Viktor Yanukovych. Both Yanukovych and Shevardnadze were men who said, we're going to go a bit more Western, but still be friends with Russia as a country that we have a great deal of shared history with, and they tried to play this balancing act, and ultimately neither men were capable enough for it to work, and I should say that Yanukovych was far less capable at that. Then all of a sudden you had Yanukovych and Shevardnadze sort of turn in terms of their narrative from being hopelessly incompetent in terms of being able to balance West versus Russia into people who were Russian agents, when the opposite was true. If anything, the Russians were a bit peeved at the lack of decision among these men. So you have a Rose Revolution in Georgia, you have a Maidan Revolution in Ukraine, you have an American stool pigeon government that's in there with Poroshenko in Kiev and Saakashvili in Tbilisi. They engage in a war of aggression against breakaway provinces that wish to retain their historic ethnic, cultural, linguistic, and geographical ties with Russia. It doesn't work out the way they planned, and then they start becoming incredibly unpopular as they end up ruining the economy they were supposed to save, imprisoning opposition who they were supposed to stand for in a democratic way, and having infrastructure collapse around them. Now, the only difference is that was about 10 years ago in Georgia, and it's right now in Ukraine. So it's sort of the case, if you could imagine the sort of the movie Twins, only without any Arnold Schwarzeneggers and two Danny DeVitos. That's essentially what the whole Poroshenko-Saakashvili Game of Thrones is. But what the United States didn't bet on when they sent Mr. Jobless Saakashvili to Georgia, to Ukraine, so let Obama not say that he's not a jobs-creating president, they didn't count on the fact that both of these men who have incredibly similar histories are incredibly corrupt, incredibly devious, incredibly suspicious and ambitious, wouldn't turn against each other. Boy, have they. And so right now, you have two people who attained their power initially in the same way, using the same narratives, governing in the exact same way, fighting the same losing and futile and frankly immoral, aggressive wars, that are now fighting each other to see who gets in power. I don't know if John McCain is capable of crying. I'm not sure if he has that human instinct. But if he could, seeing Poroshenko and Saakashvili of having this public power struggle might make him cry. It's like McCain's choice, Sophie's choice. Which one do I choose? Because they're both so similar in this sense. But this is where the wild card comes in. Saakashvili has been kissing John McCain's feet far longer than Poroshenko, and his background is much more intertwined with the United States than that of Poroshenko. So it helps in this sense to think of Poroshenko as the junior stooge, the junior varsity of the all-American, literally, Saakashvili. So that's why, while Saakashvili isn't taken seriously in his own country anymore, isn't taken seriously by any objective commentators in the wider world, he does stand a very serious chance of actually throwing Poroshenko out in a new Maidan-style revolution and taking power. We're not hearing about this in the way that the original Maidan coup was talked about in Western media, because that was a foreign proxy coup that was set up by the West, and the cameras were there to spit out the narrative on command. Now it's a question of two people fighting over power, but whose policies would essentially be the same. If the Western media were to showcase this new actual revolution, this new coup in Kiev, it wouldn't really suit the narrative, because you have two ideological brothers fighting each other over greed, money, position, power, and in Saakashvili's case, a passport. As to who the U.S. government favors more, I would say that that Saakashvili edges that out. He has more experience with them. He knows them better. And Poroshenko, even by the standards of those who put him in, has been a failure. The only trouble is Saakashvili's record of failure is even longer. The tragic thing about Ukraine is that a war of aggression against the Donbass republics in Donetsk and Lugansk has taken many many innocent lives. And the economy of the country has ruined the lives of many innocent people who had no part in the political upheaval and who themselves have no ill will towards the fraternal people of Russia or even necessarily towards the Russian government. But it has to be said that the comical aspect of it is absolutely otherworldly. The Saakashvili posing for selfies while threatening to commit suicide in one of the weirdest publicity stunts in Ukraine, and there are some really weird publicity stunts there, as there are people getting thrown into dumpsters, as there are mysterious disappearances, fist fights in the parliament, smoke bombs in parliament, food fights in parliament. And so the comical aspect of this has really been kicked into top gear by the presence of Saakashvili, and clownish though he is, in a battle of two Pagliacci-like characters, I wouldn't be surprised if Saakashvili comes out on top, with a little help, of course, from his old friends in the CIA.
And the prosecutor, the federal prosecutor in Kiev, was totally like dumbfounded by this local judge's decision to basically let him go out of remand, and like not even with an ankle bracelet or anything, totally a flight risk. And he said we have he was going mental. He said, "We have someone here who's totally stateless, who has pledged to overthrow the government, and you're letting him out without any conditions of bail." He said, "This is unbelievable." Who forced his way into the country with a mob over the border. Can you imagine the scene of a film, you know, with it forcing way through the border check?
Well, it's all there on YouTube, and it is as hilarious as it sounds. All I can say is, if you knew the salary or lack thereof of minor officials in Ukraine, you'd be surprised at how little a bribe Saakashvili's henchmen would have to pay this judge for him to make his ruling. The country is so fantastically corrupt. The levels of corruption, Somalia more corrupt, certainly, perhaps the Central African Republic, but after that, I struggle to think of a country where corruption isn't more implicit. I mean, if corruption were measurable in terms of a GDP, it would probably be the highest export in the Ukrainian economy. The corruption really is otherworldly.
Albania, I'll throw that in there.
Oh, absolutely. At this point, Albania is terrible. I would say Ukraine now is even worse. It wasn't 3 years ago when you had the wishy-washy Yanukovych. The mafia state in Albania was, of course, worse. But now it's a real toss-up. But in many ways, not least because it's bigger, I would say Ukraine now has the edge. And I'm no fan of the Albanian mafia state, and I'm on record on that.
Yeah, well, funny enough, if this doesn't go well for Saakashvili in the Ukraine, there's not much left. I mean, I made the point. I would have thought, with all his connections, he would have either had a board director job at Goldman Sachs in charge of emerging markets in the Balkans, or he would have gotten a partnership with a law firm. I mean, they set him up with a senior international statesman fellowship at Tufts University School of Law, and that wasn't even enough to sort of keep this guy gainfully employed. So I'm just thinking he's probably not a great lawyer, or who knows. But there's not many places left after this, and Albania is a possible destination, because guess who's running Albania now? Tony and Sherry Blair.
Absolutely.
So I think TB and Associates might be looking for a man with these extraordinary certain set of skills, as Liam Neeson would say. What do you think? Would Blair fit in with that crowd in Toronto?
Oh, Blair and he have sung each other's praises. Tony Blair's foreign secretary, David Miliband, was one of his best friends at the time that he was committing an act of aggression against South Ossetia and Abkhazia, which even the EU later admitted was indeed an act of aggression that Saakashvili's regime instigated. One of the ironies of the many weird ironies about post-coup Ukraine is that the lingua franca of Saakashvili, the way he's able to communicate with people in Ukraine, is the Russian language. No one in Georgia speaks the dialect, some would call it a language called Ukrainian, and certainly not many in Ukraine speak the very foreign language of Georgian. So he's more or less, he's speaking Russian to the people with a few local dialect phrases and bits of verbiage thrown in. But it's really the Soviet Union, which made Russian the lingua franca in places like Georgia and beyond, that has allowed Saakashvili this opportunity. He might not have such fun in Albania, but I'm sure that he could find, through John McCain or maybe the Clinton Foundation, a translator to run around there. Because once he gets kicked out of Ukraine, Albania, and then from there, I don't know, does Tony Blair have any friends in Somalia? I think not, so that may be the end of the line. But it wouldn't surprise me at this point that in a country where anything bad, in parentheses, can happen, like Ukraine, if Saakashvili might actually get his wish and take power. Even a year ago, I would have thought it was far-fetched, but it isn't anymore. He is building a movement of people, some of whom he's paying off, and some of whom are just so desperate for some sort of change that they'll go to literally anyone who's promising it. And Saakashvili fits the profile of literally anyone. Better than anyone. He's the who's who of color revolution. So they're banking on a losing horse, but at least it's a horse with a bit of kick to it. Poroshenko is looking more and more like a man without any energy left.
Yeah, the Russian candy man has certainly lost a little bit of his luster since the hype in 2014. So Saakashvili has Randy Schwenemann, who is John McCain's foreign policy advisor, is his advisor, and a lobbyist named Daniel Kunin, who's with USAID and the National Democratic Institute, two CIA front organizations, by the way, is Saakashvili's full-time, or was his full-time top advisor, probably still is, I would imagine. McCain's handpicked his handlers. So I think probably he's a CIA asset, and those are his handlers. This is being run by John McCain, most of this. And so my question, firstly, why did the judge let him out? I'm sure she got a phone call from somebody who got a phone call from you-know-who. I think that's pretty much a done deal in my head anyway. The bigger question, though, I'm thinking is why. So he must have been in a spot of bother in Tbilisi to get kicked out of his own country. And so I think the deal is, Adam, and you can tell me if I'm totally off base here or correct me to what you think the deal is. I think they said to Saakashvili, look, we've got a gig for you. Okay. And we need you to go to Odessa, and this is what you're going to be doing, and this is what we want you to do. And if you play your cards right, if you do this correctly, I don't know if he could actually pull off being carpetbagging into a presidency. That is just like historic. If he does that, he is the man, Adam. He is the man. Okay, if you can be president of two different countries and, you know, carpetbag your way into a place like the Ukraine and then become president, that is just amazing. Okay. So was this a deal that the U.S. said, hey, you come in here? Because I think, Adam, that Poroshenko hasn't prosecuted the war in the East, in the Donbass, to the United States' satisfaction. In other words, it hasn't been as violent or as brutal as they would have liked. And so I think they want to get rid of Poroshenko. And Saakashvili is there to basically destabilize and confuse the political scene in the Ukraine in order for them to put a new a celebrity of sorts, and we'll speculate who that might be in a minute. But I think they've done a deal. They said, look, you do this for us, we'll get you back to Georgia in good stead. We'll get those charges dropped. We'll get your citizenship back, and we'll make you president of Georgia again. That's what that's what I think the deal might look like. Because once you're head of state, Adam, you don't really, once you get a taste of that power and that status, it's nothing else is really going to do, unless, of course, you're Tony Blair. But he's practically head of state now in Albania. He's practically running the country. So what do you think? Do you think that this is a U.S. brokered deal to put him in to do a job, and then they're going to get him out and sort him out in Georgia? Or do you really think there's a chance that he could make history and carpetbag his way into another country's presidency?
I actually think he could. Both scenarios are incredibly possible. And in many ways, I'm sure the people in the CIA are thinking, what can we do first? And whichever one we can do first with the least amount of money and effort, we'll take. And if that doesn't work out, then we'll go to the plan B. The reason I think he actually could take over in Ukraine is because many people who were members of this original putsch regime, this post-coup regime, were indeed foreigners. They had a Lithuanian guy who was some sort of anti-corruption minister, and it turned out to be so corrupt that even he quit, and the Lithuanian government isn't any friend of Russia at this time. You had people from all over the world. You had Estonians, you had Canadians, you had U.S. citizens, all of these people who either had zero connection to Ukraine historically, or people that had Ukrainian heritage and instantly sort of did the passport swap to try to seem a bit more legitimate. And so even Putin himself made this remark that, why do you have this Georgian, ex-Georgian president running around? Are there not qualified Ukrainians to take the job, was the rhetorical question that Putin asked. And while there are some, not many people who value their lives and livelihoods would want to get into the bear pit of Ukrainian politics. As the old Sinatra song goes, that's life. It's what all the people say, riding high in April, shot down in May. And indeed, a lot of these people are shot down both literally and figuratively. 1 month, you're the anti-corruption minister. The next month, you're in jail on corruption charges. 1 month, you're looting the treasury. And the next, you're in prison. It's really, the thing with Ukrainian politics that everyone ought to know is that it was always corrupt. I'm no fan and never have been of Yanukovych, but the fact that things have gotten so much worse, you've gone from a systemic corruption to almost an otherworldly corruption. It's just, and the media there, the official media, is so insane, because there really is no more apt word to describe it. There's this guy, his name suits me at the moment, but he goes on various TV channels in Ukraine. He's a self-styled historian, and he said that Jesus Christ was Ukrainian. Socrates and Aristotle were Ukrainian. I don't remember who else he said. Mind you, the whole idea of Ukraine as a separate nation and ideology is an early 20th century invention that was pushed by Lenin because of his very peculiar and, I would say, wrong nationalities policy in the USSR. That's for another day. But you actually have people who believe this. And I've spoken to people from Ukraine, and they actually believe that it's somehow the center of the world, a kind of Athenian Renaissance, when everyone else looking in, including people who formerly supported the coup, they're looking at the place and thinking, this place is a nut house. And so anyone who does have a level head, and of course there's ordinary citizens that have very level heads, they want to do one of two things. If they know people in Russia, and if they know that they can get a job in Russia, they'll go to Russia. If they speak German or English or another European language, they'll try to get a visa to any European country they can and find work there. The best job for a Ukrainian who has a level head is to be employed in a foreign country. And those aren't just my words. Any honest Ukrainian, whether in the streets of Moscow or the streets of Berlin, will tell you just that. So that does leave the door of politics in Ukraine open to various thieves, mafiosos, thugs, neo-Nazis, ex-Georgian presidents. It's really that absurd that anything is possible. So if you're out there listening in Radioland at the local lunatic asylum, if you sniffed a bit too much glue, if the drugs you bought didn't do what they wanted them to do, you too one day could grow up to be president of Ukraine.
Well, it's just that easy, isn't it? Just it's all about timing at the end of the day. I do think it's ironic that the same mob in intimidation tactics that got the Yatsenyuk Poroshenko government into power in 2014, that Saakashvili has used the same exact mob intimidation tactics to build his insurgency, and they're crying foul in Kiev. And I just say Poroshenko essentially only has himself to blame because he allowed that viper into his nest. So he's been, I think, double-crossed by the United States in this story, and we'll see how it ends up. But you know, who's next? This is the question. And who will be replaced if it's not Saakashvili? If they can't get that carpet bag all the way into the presidential palace, what qualifications do you need to be leader of the Ukraine? I would say singing. You have to be a good singer, and maybe it's time for a female again. I'm thinking shades of Yulia Tymoshenko. Not her specifically, although that's possible Hillary late dark horse run there. But there's this Klitschko is, you know, Vitaly Klitschko, the boxer who Victoria Nuland was trying to get nested under the wing of Yatsenyuk to sort of mentor him. I think his credibility, Adam, is it safe to say it was totally shot when that phone call conversation was leaked between Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt, U.S. ambassador to Kiev? That at that point, Klitschko's credibility just went out the window. Total stooge, right?
Well, Klitschko is a man. He's been an incredibly unsuccessful mayor of Kiev, and the joke about him is that he's unintelligible in four different languages. He claims to speak Russian, Ukrainian, English, and I think one other. But he's totally indecipherable. There's clips all over the internet of him giving interviews in what is purportedly his native language, where he's talking about having conversations with dead policemen, talking about we need to unite so that our union can be more united with its unity, all sorts of things. So, I mean, he definitely, when it comes to eloquent boxers, if Muhammad Ali, my favorite, is on the super eloquent end of the spectrum, Klitschko is, I'll put it this way, he makes George Foreman sound like a Shakespearean actor. This guy is not your Muhammad Ali, who frankly would have been a very capable politician if he didn't fall ill fairly early on in his life.
Was his brother have the PhD, or was it Vitaly? His brother is a boxer as well, but one of them has a PhD apparently, but I don't know from what university or whatever.
Or in what subject.
Yeah, so it might not be Klitsch, as Victoria Nuland called him. So we've got Klitsch. He's kind of like out of the picture there. So then there's this other guy. Here's my dark horse, Adam. I'll pronounce this here. Sviatoslav Vakarichuk. Sviatoslav Vakarichuk, the lead singer of the Ukrainian pop band Okean Elzy, and he is being groomed by none other than Michael McFaul right now and being taken on a tour of introduced to the United States, doing the University of Stanford, everybody, next leadership generation seminars. 42 years old, has a PhD in physics, I believe, astrophysics. So clearly intelligent, good singer, young, and definitely could fit the bill of a reformer if marketed correctly. And think of the Trump. You know, it's nothing wrong with a celebrity being head of state now. It's totally feasible now. Trump has opened the gates, really, to that. So it's acceptable now. So I don't know. He's my leading sort of candidate right now.
I think he's very much looking at his future prospects. But I think that we might be one coup away, because he's not as stupid as some of these other characters we've mentioned. I think he may well be waiting for the Saakashvili Timoshenko or Timoshenko Saakashvili dream team, or should we say scheme team, to fail before marching straight in. In the same way that Trump himself waited quite a while. I mean, Trump was going to run for president in 88. He was going to run so many times that no one actually thought he would do it. He eventually did. And I think we might be looking at something like that there. A young man of great expectations, if we can put it that way, isn't, I don't think, going to want to jump in to the snake pit, or should we say snake pit inside a cesspit that is Ukrainian politics now. I think it will take one more seismic failure of a well-known person from the previous generation of politics, even though Saakashvili himself is quite young, but he got a head start, so politically he's of the older generation. I think it may well take one more seismic failure. That being said, anything is possible at this point, including the secession of Transcarpathia in southwestern Ukraine, where there's a Hungarian minority that are getting equally fed up with the neo-Nazi regime in Kiev, as are the Russians in the east. So you could see a state that's going to be fracturing at both ends.
Wow. And so the Crimeans are looking more and more like the geniuses that we thought they were by not hesitating to do what they did in March of 2014, the fastest snap referendum in history. So
they knew it was coming. I mean, they experienced terrible atrocities at the hands of the Nazis, and they saw how these renegades from northwestern Ukraine, an area that was historically ruled first by Austria and later by Poland, they saw that these people are bloodthirsty maniacs, so they knew exactly the kind of people that were leading the so-called Maidan in 2014. They jumped ship with the referendum. The people of Donbass did it in their own way. They haven't become part of the Russian Federation, but it's a frozen conflict. There's no way at this point that Donetsk or Lugansk will ever go back. Now you have the Transcarpathian Hungarians agitating for their for some sort of sovereign agreement in the southwest, and the Hungarian government itself is being quite responsive to them insofar as they're raising the issue publicly. You could even have a situation. Well, before we get to that, you have places like Odessa, Mariupol, Kharkov, where you have people that are Russians, Russian people, or people who are comfortable with the Ukrainian name because they grew up with it, but see no schism between that and a Russian identity. They see a broad identity as something that's entirely inclusive. There's no mutual exclusivity. So what I think in the long-term future is that you're going to see a fractured state with more places in the east either forming their own sovereign confederation or joining the Russian Federation. You'll see agitations by the Hungarians in the southwest. You'll see some of the Romanians in the even further southern regions of the southwest. And you could even see a schism between the leading oligarchs of Kiev and the neo-Nazis of the north of the northwestern regions, which were historically either Austrian or Polish, leading a kind of internal revolution amongst people who consider themselves Ukrainian but are arguing over just how extreme we're going to be. So if someone wants to rule that, I can't think of a better person than Mikhail Saakashvili, because all he'll do is hasten the decline of a state that was built on a false historical premise, run by the most corrupt tyrants, oligarchs in the world, and where incompetence and corruption are blowing in the breeze, essentially. So bring on Saakashvili, if that means a further push towards the inevitable, which is the country fracturing into what I think will be much more manageable and fair units.
And for the last thing I'll say about Saakashvili, in terms of his U.S. relationship, the rug could get pulled out from under him if this story that I'll just briefly lay out here, and we've only got a couple minutes left in this segment, but this was a set of interviews that had broadcast on Italian TV mainstream channel Canale 5, in a program. It's like Panorama. It's called The Matrix on Italian TV. Interviews with three Georgian nationality snipers conducted by Italian journalists, basically talking about their role in the Maidan in shooting snipers, killing police officers and civilians. And there was, so we're talking here, 50 snipers, 10 teams of five dispatched, including spotters on the ground from different directions. And so this documentary features these three snipers, interviews with them, Georgian military officers formerly, and recruited to carry out a special mission in Kiev in the winter of 2014 during the Maidan so-called uprising. And so they claim that they landed and were equipped and under the supervision of, well, looks like the United States Army, special operations. And so paid not much money, but you can, as Adam pointed out earlier, $5,000 for a day or two's work isn't bad. If you're from that part of the world and the average salary is 190 euros a month, $5,000 is not bad. And so this has come out on Italian TV. No one's come out to really shoot this down, which is the odd thing. I would have think that they would have gang tackled this report as being fake news, but they haven't yet. Everyone's ignoring it. And when they ignore it, Adam, it makes me think that there might be some truth here. Here's the problem. These three gentlemen are linked to none other than Mikhail Saakashvili. So there is a possibility, Adam, here that Saakashvili is also there to get a hold and destroy certain records or a certain piece of information that might implicate the real people behind the Maidan shootings that were used as the pretext for the overthrow of the government. Okay, I think he could be in there also as a cleaner as well, and that might be another motivation of him getting or seizing power, is to get control and maybe possibly do some mopping up on behalf of his paymasters in the United States. But this is potentially an explosive story. We got a minute left before we go to break. Your final thoughts on this one, Adam?
Well, absolutely. They need a new narrative, and Saakashvili, essentially, they want him to go in, sweep all of this information that was never supposed to come out under the rug. The Berkut, the police loyal to the legitimate president, Yanukovych, said from day one, the snipers were shooting at everyone, civilians, policemen, officials, everyone. Where the Western narrative was, they were shooting at protesters and therefore de facto the Yanukovych employees. We always knew that was false. This new information sheds new light on who these people actually were. Because this is being found out, because the Maidan experiment has failed by any objective standard, they need a new narrative, and Saakashvili appears to be the man who will deliver it, so they can say, look, all of that stuff that happened with this Maidan, with this putsch, it was all just practice. It was the dress rehearsal. Here's the real thing, even though, if anything, it will be even more shambolic than the first time round.
And he's working with, by the way, Optor or Canvas. This is the same sort of revolution company consultancy that helped to dethrone the Milosevic government in Belgrade, and also worked with the Arab Spring, with Tunisian activists on behalf of the U.S. State Department and probably the CIA, of course. Optor, Canvas, they have a branch in Georgia as well. I think they're called Enough. Was the name of the organization. They're now in the Ukraine. So he's clearly working with that consultancy, which is a U.S. consultancy, who, by the way, were involved in the early days of Occupy Wall Street in New York City. I have a video of, I forgot the name of the Maranovich, I can't remember the name of the one of the directors of that company, the partners, but he was there leading general assemblies in New York at the early days of Occupy Wall Street. This is called the revolution business, ladies and gentlemen. It's professional, it's organized, it's profitable. This is what goes on behind the scenes, and this is not what you'll ever hear admitted to by any of our media heroes, not least of all the ones you see in the New York Times, in the Washington Post. However, there is one journalist who called out and laid this agenda out, and miraculously, was published by The Guardian in 2011 at the height of Occupy Wall Street, and his name was me, Patrick Henningsen. I actually laid this out in 2011 in The Guardian at the height of the Occupy Wall Street protests, and said exactly what the agenda was and named Opdoor and Canvas in that story. I'm amazed, Adam, that they actually published it, actually. But it still stands up to the test of time today. So just want to thank you, Adam, and you know, thanks for sticking around a little bit over time. We're going to take a break and come back with our Christmas message after the commercial break. But thank you, Adam Gary, for your work and for being versatile enough to handle this gymnastics routine, which we managed to pull off here without any doping.
I'll see you at the Olympics. No, it's always a great pleasure.
I hope we see Russia at the Olympics. The next one seems like they're permanently banned. That's another story. And by the way, there's a story about Russian doping controversy on Sunday screening today. It's up on the website right now. It's pretty amazing. But take care, Adam. The Duran.com is your website. And check out Adam's work daily on the Duran. Follow him on Facebook and on Twitter. And I hope you have a great Christmas, Adam.
You too, Patrick. Same to you and all yours. It's a great pleasure being here.
Thanks, Adam. There he goes. Adam Gary, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to take a short break and be right back. This will be a very short commercial break. And I'll be back with my Christmas conclusions and leading up to the holidays for everybody out there. And a big shout out. I'll give a shout out to some of our friends and supporters as well after the break. But I have something serious I want to say after the break as well. So stick around for that. This is the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We'll be right back.